Hi, Susan Waltman, Greater New York Hospital Association. I am joined at my end by a very large assemblage of Greater New York Hospital Association and GNYJ services staff who really are working nearly round the clock on behalf of our members. We have a lot of people on the phone from a lot of different city, state, and federal agencies. I'm going to get back to who is on the phone, however, because there are several people who need to get on and off very quickly, and we'll come back to some of the detail there. I will just introduce the topic for the day, and then we will go to Dr. Ross Wilson from HHC, Dr. Zucker from State Health Department. Obviously, the commissioner will be joining us as well and can only do so for a short period of time. The purpose of today's call is to focus on personal protective equipment, and the design is to focus on to really focus on the recommendations by the CDC and the requirements of New York State, because it has come out in a commissioner's order that many of these are requirements for all hospitals. We would like to walk through the what those requirements and recommendations are, allow you to ask questions at some point. We recognize that the paramount focus is obviously on the safety of our workforce. You are the ones, you are members who look your workforce in the eye. And our job is not just to make them safe, but make them feel safe, so we understand that. At the same time, there are shortage items that mean it becomes very important to look at equivalencies. That's always a challenge, so we'll discuss that very much, PAPRs and other items. We have our supply people on the phone and discuss what OEM and the state and the feds are doing in that regard. But I think what we really most want to do is cover the territory of PPE as it relates to protecting our workforce. We know it's of interest what other facilities are doing, how they are coping with these shortages, and how they are working the equivalency of N95s and PAPRs into their particular implementation plans. I just want to emphasize, you get to make the decisions within reason, with constraint of supplies, as to what you use. You should follow the recommendations. We know some people are going for higher standards. We don't want anyone to think we are questioning the standards that you are choosing for your workforce. So I'm just going to, at this point, turn this over to Dr. Ross Wilson, whom you know is the Senior Vice President, Corporate Chief Medical Officer from HHC. And they are obviously amazing in what they are doing. They are setting the standard in terms of their ability to step up to the plate. And I would like Dr. Wilson to discuss some of their activities there and the particular focus on PPE. Thank you so much, Dr. Wilson.
Thank you, Susan, and good morning, everybody. I'd like to thank Greater New York for the opportunity to be able to reach out and share some of our lessons. We have done that with some of the designated hospitals as well. I'd also like to thank all the agencies involved for the support that they've given us from the City Health Department, State Health Department, City Agencies, CDC. And I'd like to thank for a number of calls that we've had from providers around the city and the state offering us support on the journey that we're on. And it's a pretty complicated journey. I thought I would address a couple of things. First, I'd like to start addressing the PPE question that we are using in all 11 emergency departments that we have across the city. We have 11 EDs. We treat about 1.2 million patients a year through those EDs. And we've endeavored to have a standard approach to PPE, which has allowed us to have a standard approach to training and materials management across those. And we've also tried to make sure that we're very well lined up with the CDC guidance. At the facility level, if I can just be very concrete, we have no PAPRs. We use a hood, an N95 mask, a full face protection, an impervious gown, foot leg protection, foot protection, and double gloving. And that has obviously been a journey that we've taken for two reasons. One is the PAPRs increased the complexity of the training. It increased the amount of stock we needed on the shelf. And when there's a shortage of equipment, we don't want to be burning it, using it for training that's never going to come to fruition when we actually have a shortage of equipment needing to be trained to be used on a confirmed patient. Now, we've had a number of questions from different groups as to whether that's adequate or not, and one of the things that I say and is that we've actually isolated 35 patients at our EDs in the last 6 weeks on the basis of a positive travel history and symptoms. None of those patients that we've isolated at our EDs turned out to be positive for Ebola, and they all walked in. None of them came by ambulance. And at that stage of the Ebola illness, even if they were positive, they're not very infectious. The second issue is the protection we're offering is a protection that is used not just elsewhere in the world. It's the protection that is routinely used at Nebraska, one of the centers of excellence in the country. So that's been our ED approach. The only difficulty in that group has been raised in the area of labor and delivery, and our obstetricians and midwives and nurses have been concerned. What we've said, and we're happy to discuss this separately, is that firstly, the risk of there being that clinical scenario is very low, but we have trained a labor and delivery team at Bellevue, and so if a high-risk patient came in through the intake at any of our other facilities, they would be rapidly transported using EMS to Bellevue to manage that problem. So if I could stop there and perhaps go to what we're doing for the confirmed case, or cases, plural, in the isolation unit at Bellevue. In this environment, we were faced with a conundrum, which is quite reasonably we could use the same level of protection that we're using in the emergency departments. But there are a couple of differences. One is that the staff involved in the confirmed case are actually in the room for longer periods of time. And secondly, that the patients in that environment could get worse quite quickly, either with profuse diarrhea and vomiting or other reasons for increasing splash or aerosol hazard. And the third reason was that if we trained on two different forms of PPE, it could be confusing for a staff in a stable team. So in that environment, we are using the addition of Tyvek suits and the addition of PAPRs. Now, the PAPRs discussion was a complicated one, but the comfort aspect over time was the thing that swayed our staff to want to go in that direction. The Tyvek suits are the standard Tyvek suits, the coveralls. They are not the Tychem suits. There is no reason to use the Tychem suits because they are really impervious to everything, including chemicals, and they are incredibly hot. And we only use Tychem suits in one place, and that's for hospital police at the emergency department level if there's a need to deal with a flight risk patient in the emergency department. So we're in the situation of trying to then work out how we preserve all this PPE, because right now many of us are competing against each other for scarce supplies, and many of the supplies probably ending up in places that are not very likely to need them, and supplies that for hospitals that are designated are struggling to get supplies. So the first thing is to make sure we can prioritize how supplies get to various places, and that's been a complicated process, and I know City efforts, OEM efforts, Greater New York efforts, I welcome all of them because we need you to be successful at that. The second thing is to actually not burn PPE in training unnecessary people. And one of the issues that we dealt with in implementing the commissioner's order was to actually help facilities identify the covered personnel, because the number of covered personnel under that order determines how much training you have to do, and it determines how much equipment that actually gets used in that training. And so you need to be very careful about how we make this work. It is really important that we are all in this together. Let's hope we don't have another confirmed patient, but HHC has been preparing for a couple of months to do this, and I have to tell you that the team at Bellevue are fabulous. The support from everywhere is great, but the impact on our organization of the effort is really quite profound. And so we want to make sure that we're not limited by either the availability of the correct equipment, and we're not limited by the confidence of our nursing staff and other staff who have to enter into the room of Dr. Spencer. So Susan, perhaps I could stop there. I will stay on the call as long as I can, and I'm prepared to take questions if that's in order.
I think that's fabulous, and I just do, we'll come back to, there is a question that is expressly for you, if you can hold on, and I do understand, and you did say you could, and I just appreciate the clarity that you brought to what you do, because I think there is, people very much respect how you are handling this, what you are going through, and the demands, and knowing how you are handling it is exceptionally important. Dr. Zucker, I understand that you were on and have only a short time with us as well. Do you want to? Are you available to speak now? Okay, so the State Health Commissioner was on and may have gotten off. We'll wait to see if he is back on. Now, Karen, I don't know how this works. There is one question that really is aimed at Dr. Wilson. So while he's on, there is a question from a Mr. Kavanaugh, I believe, at 10:13. Can you free, or do I just read it? Is that correct? Okay, so Dr. Wilson, it says, can Bellevue describe the hood they are using without PAPRs?
So the hoods that we're using without PAPRs are in the emergency department at each of our 11 hospitals. And they are a full head cover that's impervious. We can actually, if you get an email address, we're happy to share model numbers and stock numbers with people. So it's a full head cover hood that comes down over the top of an impervious gown. There is an N95 mask, and over the front of that, there's a full face helmet.
I can share that as well at FDNY.
Yes. Go ahead. Dr. Prezant from the fire department, EMS is on the phone, medical director. Dr. Prezant, do you want to proceed?
Sure. First off, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. It's an absolute pleasure to serve all of you by being able to transfer patients and deliver patients in this time of need. And there is absolutely nothing that Dr. Ross Wilson said that I disagree with. I think it was succinct, articulate, and to the point. To just emphasize that FDNY, we have a specialized group of people that were already trained in how to take care of these individuals. And we had to step up very quickly to provide that service. We could not, in the time required, train all 3,500 EMTs and paramedics that FDNY has, plus all of the similar-like crews that the voluntaries have, between the time we stepped up and now. That would have been impossible. So what we did was we designated our best-trained people, our already-trained people, to deliver these patients. And that was our HAZTAC crew, who are trained for chemical, biological, and nuclear events. Because of that, they have a set piece of equipment, a set piece of personal protective ensemble that is much greater than what is needed for Ebola, but that's what they already owned, that's what they were already comfortable in. So when you see our units coming for a fever travel, possible or confirmed Ebola patient, it's those units. That's why they are in a Thai chem suit and a PAPR, because that's the suits they wear for chemical emergencies as well. But even those crews have told us that for regular Ebola care, a Thai chem suit is incredibly uncomfortable. It doesn't breathe. And there are many equivalents that we are now purchasing and training our regular EMS crews to be able to use. They are the Tyvek suits, Tyvek QC or Tyvek SL. there is a similar one made by CleanGuard, which is the A60 suit. And every one of those suits has, as Ross Wilson described, a full hood shroud with a face shield that you can purchase as an additional item that goes over these suits. And when you use the full hood shroud with integrated face shield, you would have an N95 underneath it instead of a PAPR, and that would provide you with equivalent respiratory protection and complete coverage of the face and neck, which is essential. So when people say to me PAPR versus N95, I say no. It's PAPR versus N95 with a full face shield. We use the PAPR because that's our specially trained unit. When we move this to regular EMS, we too, just like Dr. Wilson said, will be using the N95 with the full face shield. Very comfortable, possibly even more comfortable than PAPR. Doesn't weigh as much, but it really is valuable for an emergency department, for a well environmentally controlled unit. Our ambulances are not always fully air conditioned, so that's one of the stumbling blocks we've had.
Susan, it's Russ Wilson here. Can I just make one other comment?
Absolutely, sir.
There's just one other piece that I'd like to add from the hospital point of view, and I thank David for his comments, and that is that if you start training staff on one level of PPE and then you change it, some staff will feel like you're giving them less protection. And particularly for staff who are not fully confident, that is quite difficult. And so once we started with PAPRs in the confirmed area, we can't go back from that without actually disturbing the morale and confidence of our staff. And so this is very much about getting it right from the beginning, because changing PPE and changing training partway through treating a confirmed case is a risky thing to do.
I absolutely agree, Ross. That's why with our HAZ-TAC units, we've stuck with the PAPRs, but we've been able to tell our regular EMS crews that we're now training that a full face shield, hood, shroud, N95 is exactly what they use in the biocontainment unit at University of Nebraska, even in their ICUs. So once you train in one, best to stay in one.
Thank you. I mean, those are excellent points, and I want to just, I'll throw a question out that, just to be clear for everyone on the phone, many of you are just on the phone. Some of you have logged into the webinar. So if you logged into the webinar, you can type in questions. Later on, for those of you who are on the phone, there'll be a time where the lines will be open and you can open additional questions in case you kind of wonder where some of these questions are coming from. But one of the people logged into the webinar, Dr. Ross, asked about your Dr. Wilson asked about your definition of covered personnel, and I guess that's a term that you use, but it's also a term that is used in the state's, the commissioner's order, so I'm not sure whether it was just related to how you're defining it within your emergency departments, but it could be also something that the state health department might want to comment upon. So I'll throw it first to Dr. Wilson.
So I was using the term covered personnel in the same context as the commissioner's order. And as our experience in implementing that was that some of our facilities threw a very wide net over that group of people and so ended up with quite large numbers of people. And other facilities were a little more careful to make sure that they had trained people on each tour in the emergency department, or whether it was the emergency department or the walk-in clinic, et cetera. But they didn't actually propose to train everybody. And that way, they actually were able to make sure that they had people who were trained on every tour very quickly. The bigger that you cast your net, the more equipment you burn during training and the more you dilute your training resources. So you have to find a middle ground in that process. And with nearly 15 or 16 facilities trying to do this, we had an amazing variation between facilities, from those that were incredibly tight in their definition to those that were very broad. And somewhere in the middle is the right answer to this question. And I think we've got to be careful that the net isn't cast so wide that we end up burning all the PPE that we need to treat patients with.
That's very helpful. And yes, of course, I knew, of course, you would be working within the context of the commissioner's order. I just will offer the opportunity to Ruth Leslie, Bob Welch that are on the phone from the state, if you want to make a comment on that. But I assume Bellevue's got it right in its EDs. If you want to add something, Ruth, on that point.
No, I think that Dr. Wilson has the right of it. We're looking for those covered personnel. We're asking to be the individuals that the hospitals are identifying that are going to be providing care to the patient. That's not meant to include and be inclusive of every single employee in the organization, but rather those that are going to be, you know, more directly involved in the care of the patient.
I have to go now. This is Dave Prezant signing off.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let me do this. I know that Dr. Zucker was pulled away. He may join us. He did want to address this group, and we'll see when somebody will tell us when he gets on. But let me do this. What we did for this call is ask the CDC to join us for this. So those of you from the CDC may say, you don't need me. You just got to lecture yourself on what you should be using. But we do. We're just very appreciative to have Dr. Srinivasan on the phone and then Abigail Tumpy from the communications end. If you went to the major initiative that we had, the rally, so to speak, the program, the educational program at the Javits Center a couple weeks ago, it is Dr. Srinivasan who spoke then, and we have his slides on our website. We have them in the package. If you look at your website, look at the webinar, there's a kind of a roadmap to that on our website. I think this is the premise of a lot of what we're working on now, the CDC guidance updated effective October 20th. He is the expert in terms of its application. And so I do want to give the floor to you, Dr. Srinivasan, and have you comment upon the PPE issues, allow people to ask questions. You hear there's a great deal of focus on the equivalency, of course.
Thank you, Susan, and I agree that you've heard from the most important experts of all, and those are the folks who are providing the care there in Bellevue. And I'll point out that our guidance document, the CDC document, was extensively reviewed and edits made based on comments from other folks around the country who have been providing care for patients with Ebola that have been hospitalized in the United States at Emory, at Nebraska, at the NIH Clinical Center. And there was agreement from all of the experts, both in this country and abroad, who reviewed the guidance document, that the two options that are recommended are both effective options in preventing the spread of Ebola and for keeping healthcare workers, healthcare personnel safe while they are providing that care. The key point that's emphasized is that there needs to be protection of the skin, so no skin exposed to prevent the transmission through bodily fluids. And we do recommend respiratory protection, again, not because Ebola is an airborne virus, but because there, in some cases, has been a need to potentially perform an aerosol-generating procedure on a hospitalized patient, and I think that's a key point that Dr. Wilson emphasized. These have all been patients who have been hospitalized, and that respiratory protection means you're ready in case something like that were to happen, you would be ready. But there's experience in this country with both the PAPRs and the N95s. And both of these have been used successfully to safely care for patients with Ebola. And I think those are the main points that I want to emphasize. The key, and I think Dr. Wilson emphasized this in his comments as well, the key is training, the key is practice, and it's observation. It's making sure you know how to use what your facility has selected, that you're trained on it, and that you have an observer, someone who's watching you put it on, and then perhaps even more importantly, watching you very carefully take it off. We do have some videos that are up. I think there's one on Medscape's site that's free. You don't have to be a Medscape member to see this video of folks putting on and taking off the protective equipment, and we will have some additional videos that we think should be online very, very shortly. I think that's those are the main points that I'd want to cover, Susan.
Yes, thank you so much, Sarah. And I know that you have to get off the phone by 10:40, 10:45. So we have a couple. Can you sort the questions that I'm going to put to the group? And you, while I've got Dr. Srinivasan, okay, so let's see here. There's a question about timetable for changes in PPE relative to clinics' outpatient settings. So is there anticipated to be, is the notion being, Kelly, that I always have to interpret people's questions, that the CDC is coming out with guidance?
Yeah, that's a good point. I should have mentioned that, Susan. Thank you. I'm glad the questioner asks about that. There is guidance for PPE in the emergency departments. That's up. There is going to be guidance for ambulatory clinics, and that should be up very, very soon. That's an important issue. People have raised it, and we agree. So there will be guidance on it's not just PPE, of course. It's the evaluation and isolation of patients who present to ambulatory clinics who may have Ebola. And again, I do want to emphasize that as the changes are being made to the way that we're handling these patients in this country, now patients who are coming from these regions are being very actively monitored by public health authorities. So increasingly, we're touching base with these folks on a daily basis. They're being monitored. So the odds that someone is going to just walk into a clinic who we don't know, who we don't know about in terms of travel history or symptoms, that risk will go way down as we are monitoring these folks more carefully. But nonetheless, we will have guidance for the ambulatory setting that'll be forthcoming.
And on that front, and let me just I'm going beyond my expertise, obviously. There are, for the State Department of Health, and also the city has guidance on ambulatory settings. My understanding is separate from what the CDC might put out there, might be coming out with, that in those settings where you go through the, and Ruth, you got to correct me here, or somebody from the city, that you do need to go through the same kind of analysis in terms of screening identification. And once you do isolate a patient, you are then recommending, I gather, that those individuals wear the same equipment, the N95 face shield, or is that
good question? No, we're not. So for the ambulatory setting, the principle there really is, it's a situation where the person has walked in to the ambulatory setting. And so by definition, they're not hospital-level ill. So the recommendation there really is, and I think this is very consistent with what New York has already recommended, and if there's someone from New York, they can comment, but the key is to, do that screening at the front end, and some of this could even be done over the phone if it's an ambulatory clinic where people are coming for appointments. But if a person happens to walk in and says, yes, I've traveled, and yes, I have symptoms, I'm ill, it's to put that patient in a room, close the door, and inform the health department. And if someone has to go into that room, there is some PPE, some personal protective equipment that's recommended, but different from what would be recommended when you're providing care for a hospitalized patient, very similar to the principles that Dr. Wilson outlined. And New York, I know, does have good guidance already up, and CDC will have guidance before long.
And Susan, it's Marcy Layton. I have to just echo what Arjun just said, that we have guidance on outpatient how outpatient providers should handle this. And if, you know, what we do say is ideally get the patient in a single room. As soon as you have any concerns, call us. And then depending on how concerning the story is, if we think the patient needs to be evaluated for Ebola, we will arrange transport to an appropriate facility. So we would want to minimize any contact in an outpatient-type setting. But most of the calls we've gotten, we've been able to quickly rule out any concern, and obviously, since there's only been one case, and then people can go in with appropriate PPE for whatever the patient's symptoms are as per normal routine activities.
Thank you very much. I want to use the time that Dr. Srinivasan's on. That I don't know whether Dr. Wilson had to get off, and I certainly would understand that. I will,
I'm still here, typing
some questions, which I think are really supply-related, which we will deal with later or separately, and that's, I do understand this. But I just want to, I guess it's a clarification that someone asked. Please review the specific PPE being used in the emergency departments. Do you read that, Kelly, as a question that's for Dr. Wilson? I think it's going to hew to the CDC recommendations, but Dr. Wilson, I think that's for you to comment upon. The specific PPE being used in your emergency departments.
So the our approach is consistent with the CDC advice. It is an impervious hood. It is an N95 mask with a full face shield. It's an impervious gown over hopefully disposable scrubs, otherwise normal scrubs. It's leg protection and foot protection, and then double gloving.
Thank you. And I'm going to do this. If there's someone on the Karen, this may be like unruly way to approach this because the CDC people do need to get off. Are there, could you open the phone line? We can see questions, obviously, that are being typed in. Could you open the phone line to get maybe one or two questions for Dr. Srinivasan before he needs to get off, and then we will put everybody back in the listening mode and continue the program.
Would you like me to unmute everyone? Or just?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Susan, I'll sign off now, okay?
So much. Thank you very, very much, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's a little noisy. How about we just say if anyone should have a question for the doctor to please press star 1 on their telephone keypad at this time.
And again, we'll have questions at the end. I just did not want, if you had a specific question for the CDC.
And we have a question from Mary Ferranda from MJHS. Please state your question.
I actually have a question regarding the outpatient setting for home care. In the absence of guidance for home care and for long-term care right now, we are burning up some equipment in training, and it sounds like we shouldn't be, but there is really no guidance for nurses and home health aides that are going out in the field and may come in contact with a patient that might have symptoms. Is there guidance coming out for those settings, and what sort of PPE is recommended in those?
This is Arjun. It's a good question, and I can take this back to the group, so I appreciate the suggestion. You know, I think what's key for home health, folks who are going into the home, is using, again, this idea of the telephone as an important piece of protective equipment. There should be a phone call to the house before home health is delivered to find out if there's someone in the home who has traveled, and if they have symptoms. There shouldn't be unexpected people at homes who have symptoms, and again, that, you know, should be, I would think, changing as more of these folks come under, you know, more active monitoring. But to be careful, there certainly could be a phone call in advance to find out if that's the case, and then, you know, determine what needs to be done. Obviously, if there's someone in a home who has traveled and has symptoms, that is someone who the public health authorities would very much want to know about. And so, you know, my advice would be that would be someone who a phone call needs to go to the health department. And Marcy, if you're still on, would love to hear your thoughts and comments on that.
Susan, hi, this is Deb Satellano from State Health, and I did want to mention that we will be sending a guidance letter out to our home care agencies and associations and providers very shortly. And it, basically, we're recommending the same ideas that we feel that the patients who have, you know, been being monitored or under quarantine will be known, and that the providers can contact local health and keep an active communication with local health about those patients, just as was just said. So that's very similar to what we're writing.
I actually had another question that had come up is on the weekends, because I'm so sorry.
Can we just, I am very conscious of your time, Dr. Srinivasan. If it's a really quick question, we'll take it. But I'd like to give other people the opportunity before he gets off.
Yeah, they just wanted to know whether the local health departments are being staffed 24/7, that the same number would apply over the weekends.
I'll have to defer that to folks from the city and state who are there.
Right. For the state, we have the duty officers' numbers that are published for the local health departments to contact on over the weekends or on a 24/7 basis.
And for the city, our provider access line is our 24-hour number after hours, which are later than usual. It rolls to poison control, and we always have at least two physicians on call. And I was about to say, I agree with Arjun's comments about home care. I should acknowledge, you know, we are doing visits on the persons under quarantine, and our staff call before they go to just make sure things are okay, so they know. In addition to just knowing whether the patients have traveled, I would think the regular home care staff would know that from their regular visits if anyone had recently traveled, including the patients.
Thank you. Any other questions on the phone?
Yes. We do have another question from Doris Trinacosta from St. Joseph's. Please state your question.
Hi. We were just wondering, has there been any definitive guidance around what the patient specifically needs to wear as they're being transported from point of entry to the ultimate isolation room?
This is Arjun. No, we don't have strong guidance on that. You know, I think that some places are putting a mask on the patient might be helpful if they're coughing or sneezing. But, you know, I think the key is to, you know, get the patient into an isolation area quickly. If they are going to be transported to a room, you know, determining what the safest way to do that is. It's one where it really is so variable. I don't think that there could be uniform guidance. You know, some of these patients come and they're ambulatory. So they're, you know, there's no vomiting, there's no diarrhea. And in that situation, there really would be not a need for much PPE on the patient themselves, maybe just a mask. In some cases, if a patient had a lot of vomiting and diarrhea, there may be something else that needed to be done. But I really think that's something that you have to determine based on the patient. Another thing to keep in mind is that, you know, in some situations where if you know the patient is very, very high risk and is coming in, such as what the case was in New York, some of those patients may not be going to the emergency department. They may be going straight up to the floor from the EMS. And in that case, obviously, the EMS folks would be handling PPE. So we don't have specific guidance around that.
I have one more question that someone's typed in that I know I would really like you to speak to, Dr. Srinivasan. So last one. So the question is, the face shield we have still leaves the eyes exposed from the side. Can eye protection be also used?
You know, eye protection can be used. We did not recommend it because, you know, we are recommending the full face shields, which do come around to the sides. The issue with the eye protection There's nothing wrong with it in terms of it, but you know, you do have to consider one of the challenges that people had with goggles was that they do tend to fog if you're wearing, especially if you're wearing a respirator. And they can become, if they start to fog and become uncomfortable, there's a tremendous temptation to touch them and manipulate them. And that's obviously something we really want to avoid, is people bringing their hands up to their faces. And that's why the recommendation from folks was move away from things like goggles, which could get uncomfortable and fog and provide the temptation for people to touch their faces, and move to something like a face shield that goes around to the sides, which is much more comfortable. So that's the issue with the goggles. I have talked to places that are, you know, using goggles, and they've come up with ways to, you know, prevent them from fogging. But the key again here, this gets to training and practice. So they've been practicing, they've been doing training, and they feel comfortable that their goggles won't fog, and the healthcare workers won't feel the need to adjust them because they've had healthcare workers practice with them and staying in them for hours at a time. So if you're going that route, those are the issues that you'll need to consider. And then you have to consider, are they disposable, or are you going to have to develop protocols for having them cleaned?
One more thing, and I know I said one more thing before, but there is something on, it says DuPont, the manufacturer of Tychem Tyvek products, has issued a technical bulletin for EVD. Tyvek does appear to have limitations with Tychem recommended. Now, we've already heard, obviously, from Dr. Wilson, Dr. Prezant, with respect to those issues. Would you comment one, and I promise I will let you off the phone, about where Tyvek, Tychem, et cetera, fits into the CDC guidance?
You know, that's a good question. I have not seen what you're referring to. Maybe if you send it my way, I can take a look. I can't really speak to the specifics of what that document is referring to. There are, you know, different standards for different types of gowns. The key that we emphasize, of course, is the impermeability issue, because the body fluid exposures are important. But as I've said before, you know, we view this as an ongoing dialogue. I'm not going anywhere after this call. And so if you, Susan, you know, want to send us that document, we'd be happy to take a look and could perhaps address that on the next call or in a follow-up email or something like that.
Perfect. Thank you so, so much. I appreciate it, and thank you for the others on the phone who might have questions. And thank you, Dr. Srinivasan, as well as Abigail Tumpy, for joining us, and maybe we'll have more of these on our website, and I'm not ending the call by any means, but we do have a series of slides that we have up on the webinar for the webinar group, and we'll send out, that go through a lot of resources, and it does kind of key you into the slides that were presented by the CDC, the PPE demo that is on our website, for example, that the CDC did with Barbara Smith from Mount Sinai as the person donning and doffing quite expertly the equipment under the guidance of a CDC individual with a checklist, a script. So thank you very much. There are still a lot of our experts on the phone. We have city and state health on, obviously, OEM. And I'd just like to, I'll just open the floor about to all of you from the agencies. If there are specific comments to make, I then wanted to move to the supply end of things and what we are doing and what we are doing with the city, state, and federal government. So State Department of Health, City Health Department, or OEM, want to make a comment at this point? Ruth, or I don't want to call on people, but just Ruth, Marcy, Morty at OEM, anybody want to make a comment? Okay.
It's Marcy. I don't have anything specific to say. I obviously a lot has been going on these past 2 weeks, or this past week since we did the last call, both with Greater New York, and we did a follow-up call, I think, a week ago Friday, we did develop a sort of slightly refined algorithm for evaluating patients in the emergency department that's up on our website and is being laminated we will be getting that out shortly. It's not that much subtly different than the one we had before, but we thought it just made things clearer about how to evaluate patients in the emergency department. So it's up on our website and we'll be getting it out via both probably a hand and actually giving laminated copies to hospitals. And we remain available to triage calls. We continue to get calls, actually not that many, so I think New York City hospitals and healthcare facilities are getting more comfortable with triaging calls, as I keep emphasizing, sort of balancing early recognition and isolation and calling us for people who truly meet the criteria, but not over responding to patients who clearly don't, given our concerns about delaying essential medical care and or stigmatization. We recognize it's a balance, and we've got actually, instead of two docs on call every night, we now have three docs on call every night and on weekends to help triage calls, we remain available as needed.
I just want to, I'll ask Dr. Zucker, did you join? I know, I guess you were on once and maybe not on a speaker line. I just want to give you the opportunity to speak if you've joined. Star 1, Dr. Zucker, if you are not on a speaker line. Star 1 on your phone. Okay, so let me go on. I just want to make a couple comments about, and if you do want to do star 1 while we're continuing here, and I do want to finish this up by 11, I want to make a comment about supply. So we have a very large group purchasing subsidiary that works with Premier. We are able to get you a lot of supplies, those of you participating members in that, and we do have quite a team in the room. Lee Perlman, Chris O'Connor, you have Jeff Ashkenazi, Jay Flickstein, and a larger crew trying to track down supplies. And the basic supplies that the CDC recommends are available. They are tightening up. Sometimes there are distributional issues, but they are very much trying to make sure you have the supplies that you need. We do know that there are two categories of items that are very difficult to get. One is the PAPRs, which is why you're hearing so much conversation on here on this call about wanting to make sure that the equipment that is being used is appropriate for the setting and for the particular patient, for example. So that's why you keep hearing about that the N95s are considered equivalent, and some of the precautionary words about moving to PAPRs, but they are very much in short supply. I will say it is temporal because more are being made. It's just that there's a pipeline that's out there. We recognize that they are very, very important to our designated centers to get up and running to be used in the right settings and circumstances. We have been able, and my guys are going to kick me under the table here, we have been able to find supply for the designated centers, but the more the ordering, comes in, it becomes more and more difficult. And of course, the related products such as hoods and other things are difficult to find, but we are finding a lot of them. So I just want to put that aside for the moment. The Tyvek Tycam, where you've heard a discussion about that, are similarly shortage items. So I just want to tell you where some things are. Morty Goldfeder's on the phone from OEM, and he can comment if he wishes. We really have done an awful lot through our national purchasing activities on your behalf, finding what we can, and at the same time working with city, state, and federal governments with respect to what's available in stockpiles, very much working closely with them, and that went back a week plus, so it's not something we woke up today. But we've been working with the city, which has, and the state, very much, Nikhil Natarajan's on the phone, to try to get more supply to you as you need it and where you need it. And therefore, what is being discussed, and I'll just go over this very quickly, is the fact that it may be that the city will become a sole point of contact for identifying and purchasing certain of this equipment, which we would be helping them with and working with them, but all with the design of getting more product, being able to get to to obtain more product and make sure that it is allocated and where it is most needed. And that's really to get the power of the governmental authorities to deal with the state and the federal. We have no problems with the state. They get us what they can get us. And then the federal government. So there is some discussion about moving to a model that would do that, and that is meant to protect you. It is not a run on the bank. It is meant to protect you, and we are doing everything we can to identify supply at the same time. And I just do put that out there that it isn't something that is a declaration necessarily, but something that OEM is trying to do on your behalf. In addition, they have also ordered, I think it's 180 approximately PAPRs. They are not the kind you would necessarily use in a hospital, but they are there in the stockpile that will be there by Saturday, I believe, a major expenditure in that regard. They are very much obviously aimed at trying to get you the supplies that you need. We continue to try to identify supplies as well and meeting, I would say, almost all of your requests. Sometimes there is a delay in terms of delivery, but we continue to do that as well. The city, the state, the feds are working hard in order to get the supply where it's needed. Morty, do you want to comment at all? I know that was kind of what you're doing. Do you want to comment on the process at OEM?
I'll go ahead and make his line live. Morty, your line is live.
You don't have to say something, Morty. It's okay.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so that's exactly right, Susan. We did have a purchase. We do expect delivery on Saturday. And we're also purchasing all the other needs as well. And we're looking to keep a stockpile of that. So should an emergency arise that you know, maybe a hospital is not prepared for 100%, you know, through the normal process, we will be able to help you. I do understand that some of the equipment you may not be trained on, so sometimes it may need some lead time, but we will work with you to help in any way we can.
And I know that we have members outside of the city clearly, so this isn't meant to, the whole effort is of course aimed at our members, and we have members upstate that are designated centers and out on Long Island, so we are checking with them, and the state is obviously part and parcel of this initiative. And I do hope, as I wrote to the city, wrote an email this morning, it's temporal, hopefully. We think it's circumstantial that, you know, it's sometimes will be dependent on where the next case shows up, and demand is an interesting obvious phenomena. And we wanted to make it as clear as possible as part of this call when you really need some of these shortage items and when you do not, and therefore the city and the state will be sending out a letter that kind of reinforces some of these notions that will be coming out. I want to do this. A lot of the questions that I see on the typed in are really kind of product specific, and we're going to try to put out a frequently asked questions document on that. I want to draw the attention of those of you who are on the webinar to the slides that you see. We're going to do kind of a strobe version walkthrough with them, and I'll tell you, for those of you just on the phone, what we're seeing, and then we'll send them out. But it's a section on personal protective equipment where we brought some resources together. So you know this very well, but it's in there. It's just driving you to some of the resources. CDC guidance we talked about, emphasizing the N95 versus the PAPR and what's required when you do have the N95, a lot of discussion we've already had about shields and hoods, and then the fact sheet that is from the CDC, which I think is a useful overview if you don't, you know, rather than going through the guidance itself. We have the reference to Dr. Srinivasan's slides that he did at the 1199 Greater New York program at the Javits Center, if they are of value, and the specific demo that was done, as I indicated, by the CDC with Barbara Smith going through the donning and the doffing. That's available on our website. And then we do link you to the HHC website, where they do have a lot of the materials that they've posted, fact sheets, et cetera. Finally, in University of Nebraska, PPE resources. Everybody talks about Emory. They're very, very important, obviously. But what's useful is to demonstrate that, as you heard from others on the phone, that the University of Nebraska Medical Center, which is a one of the four biocontainment units in the United States of America, does have its charts for donning and doffing and the references to N95. We do have here, just to make you aware, also what the anesthesia, you have the surgical anesthesia. Okay, so it's the American Anesthesia Association guidelines that just came out. We bring your attention to that. So it's for routine situations with Ebola patients, for example. It does have the N95s, but it makes it clear that when you're doing, we all know this, aerosolized procedures to move to the PAPRs, as you know, the distinguishing feature and part of the reason that PAPRs are even are in some of these documents. And then you want to go through that. And then we have some other federal resources. You know where they are, but we just wanted to make sure you had this compendium of things that you could turn to. Clinical management, waste management is in there, so we show you the actual documents to go to. ACOG is actually developing. We've had many questions with respect to what to do with OBGYN situations. So ACOG is developing some guidelines in that regard, and they ask for resources. We also get into some of the state websites, city websites there, and some of their fact sheets. And then finally, you need to go ahead, New York's, okay, we've got some of the city things, and finally some educational materials that others have put out, the CDC, the POM card by the city, the link and to the Emory resources. And then finally, it's just very interesting to show this. The Nebraska Medical Center had some of its nurses, and there are two different actual videos of nurses talking about how they feel safe in the biocontainment unit in Nebraska. And there's it's YouTube, so we give you the link. If you go to that YouTube page, there is also another YouTube video about the director of nursing for the biocontainment unit. And you may find that useful to show to your own workforce, not just because they're nurses and not just because they're comfortable, but because they also, in that particular location, use the N95s. And I don't mean to be preaching. It's just that I found that a very calming discussion that the two nurses have about feeling safe in that particular environment. Greater New York has prepared some checklists that are designed to help with the implementation of the commissioner's order. We will be posting them shortly. They're not there yet, but we show you what it will look like when we post them. So they're drill-down checklists that complement the Department of Health's own assessment checklists. And then just our webpage, so you see that. We will be posting frequently asked questions, the answers, on our website, and we will take all the ones you've typed in that a lot of them have to do with products that we will answer for that purpose. Yes?
The only thing I would add is that many of these resources that Susan just went through are already on the Greater New York Hospital Association website for your reference.
Yeah, it's just kind of like a compendium for you to see them. You know, I don't know about you, but I see them, and I obviously are more likely to go to them when time comes. So we're at the end of the hour. I am happy to entertain, let's say, two questions, and otherwise we will be getting, for those of you on the phone, Karen, you want to take two questions, and then you all can call us directly, supply chain people or otherwise. Karen, two questions, is that okay?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad at this time. And our first question comes from Gail Hyde from SUNY Upstate. Please state your question. Gail, your line is live.
Hi, this is Dr. Javed. I'm calling from SUNY Upstate. My question is regarding actually transfers, and other hospitals in our area are asking about their processes of how they should transfer patients here. I think there is a lot of confusion in outlying hospitals regarding what state has mandated, and we need a little bit more clarification.
I don't know, Ruth or Nicole, is that a question for you from the State Department of Health? And maybe we lost the state people.
We're here. We were just could you repeat the question, Susan? Would you mind?
Yeah, the question I believe had to do because it's, you know, we've had a lot of there are procedures in New York City with respect to transfers of patients and movement of patients. So we have a question from SUNY Upstate, which is in Syracuse, about transfer of patients. And if I need to clarify the question, sir, please do that for me.
Yes, basically, almost every hospital in last 3 to 5 days has called us. And if they haven't, they will be calling us, and they do not know exactly what is expected of them. Our area is huge, and how outlying hospitals that Upstate is designated as a center. The issue really is, like, New York City is kind of small as compared to the area we have. So we have a lot of hospitals. There's a lot of confusions as to what their transfer process would be. What we understand is they should call and coordinate with their local health department. But I think those things need to be crystal clear in one way or the other, or if you can clarify exactly what those hospitals should do, because they want us to almost vet their processes at some point if they're okay and whatnot. So I would want some clarification on that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for reiterating the question. I appreciate it. So all of this, and this isn't the answer that you want, but all of this is in process right now. I think the important piece out of that is that, you know, the non-designated hospitals know that they need to contact their local health department, who will in turn bring in the state and in CDC if need be, to have those conversations about the status of a patient that may be being evaluated or holding in isolation at a non-designated hospital. And then from there, decisions will be made about transport, who's transporting, who's ready, and just on the readiness front, you know, the Department of Health, and in some cases the New York City Department of Health and CDC for a couple have been with us when we've gone out to do our readiness assessments at different hospitals. We are in the process now of looking at the data that was collected from those assessments in terms of where non-designated hospitals are with their readiness, and so we're because you're right, they need to know certainly what they need to do to finish getting ready, or in some cases need to know what they need to do to be ready, and so we are in the process of pushing some information back out to hospitals, and I agree with you. You know, we've been spending a lot of time in energy and resources on the designated hospitals and the communication to them. And as you know, we've been talking a lot, and we have dedicated calls for those purposes. But, you know, to make sure that those hospitals are ready to give definitive treatment, I think, now we need to switch focus a little bit and provide additional information to the non-designated hospitals so that they're more confident in what they need to do. So this is all an evolution. It's definitely fluid, and we're working on it. But I'm sorry I can't give you more definitive answers than that today.
I really appreciate your long and thoughtful answer at this time. I do want to ask you one question, because we do need to answer this to everybody else who's calling us. What do we tell them today? And that really needs to be crystal clear to us. What do you want us to say to them today? Why? Because what has happened, at least some of the places have called or communicated with us, and either because they're going to get a visit from New York State, or they have had it, and an expectation is that they need to coordinate one way or the other with Upstate. Now, that expectation is not cleared,
and that creates a lot of confusion. We are getting tons of messages. We are preparing ourselves. We are improving our preparedness here daily. We're getting tons of messages. We really don't know how to answer it. We need to help everyone. Please, please tell us what do we tell them today while you prepare your answers.
I think in the reason that they're reaching out to you is because the commissioner's order basically compels them to do so. And I suspect that other designated hospitals are working with their community hospitals as well. But you've got the, you know, having the, there is tons of information out there for the non-designated hospitals to see the procedures. And in fact, there's a great document that's available on the Department of Health's website, as well as the CDC website, which is basically, I think it's important facts for ED isolation, identification, for identification and isolation of patients in emergency departments. For me, it says it all. It basically runs through the decision algorithm that hospitals, all hospitals, designated or not, should go through in terms of what they need to do to identify and isolate those patients. It has, you know, contact the local health department. I think that that's a concise document for now. It does, you know, encourage those hospitals to begin, you know, evaluation of those patients through lab work and others. I think that to me, I would direct folks back to that document to make sure they're checking the boxes with all the processes that they would need to support that, you know, that algorithm. But essentially, the additional important piece is that, you know, if they did have a suspected patient, that we would be working, you know, local and state government would be working that through with you, you know, to make and with you as being the designated hospital to, you know, to take those steps. So that would be my recommendation, to bring them back to that document, make sure that they're ready, that, you know, that they are, you know, have been in touch with you guys, that they have their transport plan in place, and then go from there.
Thank you so much. That's very kind of you.
Yeah, thank you so much for raising that question, too. I think that as the department goes around and does its assessments, obviously people are getting up to speed, or they all should be, you know, obviously following the commissioner's order and related requirements, but I know it's complicated, it's complex, and you've been concentrating very much on the downstate area. So, but I'm sure that other, you know, the upstate area might have less attention to this, so to speak. But I think everybody probably has this dilemma. One more question, Karen. Is there another question in the queue? I don't want to...
Yes, there is, and it comes from Jack Finkelstein from Wyckoff Hospital. Please state your question.
Yes, hi. Good morning, everyone. It's actually two quick statements. That ClinGuard A60, the Tyvek suit that they were talking about, just something that, you know, in our training that we discovered, that top zipper tends to fall down. And I know the recommendations is to make sure there's no skin exposed. So we added a hood to that. This is a, like, white hood that just comes straight down to make sure that the neck is covered. So it's something that those that are seeking to purchase PPEs, you know, should look into or consider. Like I said, because from our experience, you know, when they don the Tyvek suit and we have them twist and turn and bend and stretch to be sure that that's working well, we've seen that zipper come down. We also tied a little string to it, so it makes it easier for them to just pull it down when they doff. So like that, they don't even have to, you know, take the chance of possibly touching their clothes internally. And the second thing is in the transfer of patients, like if we're transferring from, say, the ED up to another isolation area in another area of the hospital, we had considered also, yeah, what should they wear and so forth. And at first I thought, well, since it's all body fluids, maybe have them wear one of those Tyvek suits. However, they will probably already be febrile and they get hot in there. So we figured we'd just put a sheet on them. But we're also looking for any guidance or recommendation, because that is something that hasn't really been addressed anywhere else.
Thank you very much, Jack. And thank you, everyone who joined this call from the agencies and all of you as members. I know you probably have more questions. There are a lot that are typed in. Some of them are specific product questions that our supply people are going to be following up and other things. We will have frequently asked questions that we will generate from this to respond. Those of you who might be in the queue from a call standpoint and didn't get your question answered, please call us. We're here. We're here for you. And as I said, there are a lot of people in this room from Greater New York who are working on your behalf. If need be, we'll schedule another call on this specific issue, but we, of course, want to continue to share the information that you need to be prepared. Thank you very much.